It's the worst standoff between Russia and the West since the end of the Cold War. Putin says Ukraine is on the brink of civil war. How should the U.S. react? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As the situation in Ukraine escalates further, we'll ask our political analysts, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa and Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, to size up the options open to the U.S. and ask what's at stake. Also, will a new climate change report change any minds in Washington? The Snowden story wins the Pulitzer, and conservatives react to Stephen Colbert taking Letterman's spot. It's Politics Wednesday. Join our discussion. It starts right after this news. We have arrived at Politics Wednesday on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's our chance, our weekly chance, to invite a couple of our numerous analysts into the studio to have them chew over latest political developments, top stories. And joining us this hour, Donna Hoffman, Chair of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa in our Cedar Falls studio. Donna, welcome back.
Thank you, Ben.
Wayne Moyer is with us, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College, joining us by phone. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing fine. We want to talk about a number of things in domestic politics a little bit later in the program, but as Ukraine continues to dominate politics around the world, we want to get to that first of all. Later in the program, though, we'll talk about a new report on climate change, the Edward Snowden story winning the Pulitzer Prize, also some new information, a new Gallup poll on the Affordable Care Act, and to finish up the hour, Stephen Colbert named to succeed David Letterman, and the political angle on that. We'll talk a little bit about that, get reaction from our analysts. We invite you to join us this hour as well. It's the worst standoff between Russia and the West since the end of the Cold War. At a White House news conference yesterday, Press Secretary Jay Carney reacted to the news that Ukrainian forces had begun to move against pro-Russian protesters in eastern Ukraine.
We agree that the use of force is not a preferred option. That said, the Ukrainian government has the responsibility to provide law and order. And these provocations in eastern Ukraine are creating a situation in which the government has to respond.
Conservative columnist Charles Krauthammer, responding on Fox News, says that Russian President Putin has little incentive not to retaliate in Ukraine because he knows Russia has nothing to fear from the U.S.
The fact that Carney went on in the press conference to say they're not even considering lethal assistance, the Ukrainians are utterly helpless, we are doing nothing, the Europeans aren't even allowing us to do anything important economically. What we are doing is holding the coat of the little guy in a fight who is essentially unarmed.
Krauthammer says the solution for Ukraine's crisis is, in his words, almost unspeakably obvious and includes providing arms and deploying NATO troops. Now, the Obama administration has left the door open to providing some military assistance to Ukraine, while ruling out providing arms or other lethal aid at this time. River to River listeners, we want you to join our discussion in this first half hour as we discuss Ukraine. Do you think the U.S. is taking appropriate action in this Ukraine crisis as it escalates? Do you worry or do you wish the U.S. would get more involved? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's turn to you first of all, Wayne Moyer. Describe the challenge the White House faces in this situation as it remains volatile.
Well, the situation in Ukraine is very tense right now. You've got all Russian troops on the border. And then you have the government in Kiev that's now sent some troops in to try to free some of these town halls, et cetera, that have been taken over by the pro-Russian groups. There's a big meeting tomorrow in Geneva, the Russians, the Ukrainians, the Americans, and the EU. And I'm looking at all of this now in the context of these negotiations, and the Russians are trying to get the West to agree to autonomy for eastern Ukraine. the United States doesn't want to see Ukraine split up. And I look at what's going on as a negotiating process. And I think to try to send arms to Ukraine at the moment would be a huge mistake and would actually be an invitation to a Russian invasion. And so I think Obama is playing it just right at the moment. Low key, I think we're trying to unify with the Europeans and thinking in terms of these negotiations and hopefully do as much as we can to preserve a united Ukraine.
Donna Hoffman, how do you see it developing?
I basically agree with Wayne, and I think tomorrow's events in Geneva will be kind of important. But, you know, Obama has, you had a quote there from Charles Krauthammer, John McCain has kind of, no surprise, been advocating for some military aid for Ukraine that is more lethal than the non-lethal that's kind of been suggested. And Obama's in a difficult position because he's always had these people who are more hawkish than he is, and will say these things. And a lot of times there's political dynamics here to try to paint Obama as being weak on foreign policy in general. But to come right out and offer military aid to the Ukraine would, in fact, be pretty provocative. And it would strengthen Putin's hand in the sense that he then could also be a little stronger than he has been, you know, moving into the eastern Ukraine, perhaps.
Let's go to our callers. 1-866-780-9100. Do you think the U.S. is taking appropriate action in the Ukraine crisis? Do you worry or do you wish the U.S. would get more involved? 1-866-780-9100. We'd love to have your thoughts. Troy is with us from Iowa City. Hi, Troy.
Yes. I was wondering, didn't the Ukraine give up their nuclear weapons because we told them if they would give them up, we would defend them?
Mm. Okay. Let's talk about that. Let's see if Wayne knows about that. Going back to the Soviet Union times, Ukraine on its soil had a significant part of the nuclear arsenal of the old Soviet Union, right, Wayne Moyer?
That's correct. And Ukraine did, in fact, return those to Russia. And there was an agreement, and the United States and Russia agreed to respect the sovereignty of Ukraine after that. So Ukraine has no nuclear weapons now.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Doug in Cedar Rapids. He dialed 1-866-780-9100, talking about the crisis in Ukraine and what the U.S. has at stake, what its options are. Doug in Cedar Rapids, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
It seems interesting that this president was elected. Part of the basis in which he was elected was complaining about how the United States was diminished in esteem internationally, and it just does not seem like anything that President Obama or his State Department have been able to do has been able to pick it up. And it doesn't matter what hemisphere, it doesn't matter which area. I saw a commentator recently say, it was rather interesting, what would Reagan do? And they said, basically, Reagan would do nothing. He would sit there and continue to watch and do what he did. Now, I understand, you know, what happened with El Salvador and the guns for arms issue with Iran. But I think that at this point, the president would be better off just leaving it alone and trying to actually create a foreign policy that had some legs on it, rather than right there, you know, what's there now is something just ineffectual.
Okay. Doug in Cedar Rapids, thank you for your viewpoint. Donna Hoffman, you keep a keen eye on presidential politics and have looked at presidents through the decades. What is your reaction to Doug's comment there?
Well, you know, it's not the Cold War, for one thing. And so the dynamics of the situation are a little different. Obama has really carved out in his first term especially, and has continued on in the second term, a look to the Pacific area in terms of his foreign policy. And really, we're a partner in NATO. And I think where you're going to see maybe some interesting dynamics happen is through actions in NATO. I mean, NATO, part of that agreement is if you're a member nation, you know, an attack on one member nation is an attack on the organization. And while Ukraine is not a member of NATO, there are the republics, the former Soviet republics that are close there are members. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, et cetera. And so NATO has stepped up some of its presence in those places, doing aerial surveillance and that kind of thing. So the president, you know, again, is in an interesting position because Putin does want to paint him as being weak. There's even people in the United States that want to paint him as being weak. But I do think the wiser strategy at this point is, as Doug mentioned, is to sit and watch and wait and see what move Putin makes next.
Let's listen to a little bit of what the NATO Secretary General said on this issue, an extended clip. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen announcing plans today to strengthen NATO's military presence along Ukraine's eastern border. Here he is speaking to reporters after a NATO Ambassador's Council at the NATO headquarters in Brussels.
Today, we agreed on a package of further military measures to reinforce our collective defense and demonstrate the strength of Allied solidarity. We will have more planes in the air, more ships on the water, and more readiness on the land. For example, air policing aircraft will fly more sorties over the Baltic region. Allied ships will deploy to the Baltic Sea, the Eastern Mediterranean, and elsewhere as required. Military staff from allied nations will deploy to enhance our preparedness, training, and exercises.
The NATO Secretary General speaking today in Brussels. Wayne Moyer, what do you hear in that list of things? Anything there likely to ratchet up the effectiveness to make Putin think twice?
I think the main effect of what NATO is doing is to reassure the Baltic countries that are right next to Russia that NATO is still holding together. And if they have large Russian minorities, and if Putin tries to do something there to reassure them that NATO will support them, I think the buildup will have no effect on Ukraine at all. The main way that will exert leverage over Ukraine is with sanctions, and the U.S. can't do it alone. And what's very critical on sanctions is that the U.S. coordinates with Germany, and Germany is very divided on this right now. So I think Obama's very limited there. But if we're really talking about influencing Ukraine, it's not so much the military as it is the economic sanctions.
Now, we want to mention NPR's Ari Shapiro. We heard a report. He's in eastern Ukraine. Locals are pushing, to separate from the central government, the Ukrainian government, and join the Russian Federation, claim that at least some of the Ukrainian troops are refusing to move against them. So it's interesting, as this story has developed over the last few days, that we're seeing the level, or trying to measure, the level of protest, the level of unrest in these eastern Ukrainian areas. Russian President Putin, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon speaking on the telephone about de-escalation yesterday. In his call, Putin emphasized that Russia expects the UN and the international community to condemn the use of force by the Ukrainian authorities in eastern Ukraine. So this is, to most of the reports that we're hearing, turning it on its head, is it not? Weeks ago, the popular uprising centered in Kiev ousted the pro-Moscow president, Viktor Yanukovych. It was an uprising backed by the West. It was called illegitimate by Moscow. Now the opposite. Uprisings of ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine backed by Russia, condemned by the West. So the question here, Donna Hoffman, is it simply a matter of whose side you're on here? Does Putin have a point?
Well, I mean, it's in Putin's interest to make that point because, you know, the pretext for annexation of the Crimea and certainly infractions into eastern Ukraine currently are that the ethnic Russian minority are being abused and that they need to be protected. And that justifies their presence there. So Putin certainly has a reason for putting the particular spin on it that he does.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we're getting reports that there is some degree of solidarity with those ethnic Russians taking government buildings, are we not, Wayne Moyer?
Well, we know that the Russians are very active in Ukraine. We have cell phone taps that we've made, and this is a coordinated operation, which is coordinated from Russia. We know they have some local support, but we don't know about the large majority of the population in the east. So I look at it all as part of the bargaining. Russia wants to make as strong a position as it can possibly make at the Geneva meeting tomorrow, and trying to say that it has a huge public support in the east, at least for autonomy. The Ukrainian government, on the other hand, by sending troops in, is also trying to strengthen its own position. And by not having them shoot, in a way, that's encouraging, because by not having exchange of fire, that helps the negotiation process.
Mm-hmm. Donna Hoffman, unlike the other military situations this president has faced, unlike Syria last year or the decision to begin military operations further back in Libya, there's no apparent public sense of urgency from the administration. How do you read that?
Well, I think they're being very careful in terms of, you know, gauging what's in U.S. interests and what's not. And that's always something that influences American foreign policy. And so, you know, again, I think that is very much a developing situation. It's not clear exactly what's happening, I think, given, you know, the state of what Putin is saying. And certainly, you know, he's saying things that are in his interest. It's a little murky in terms of what's happening within Ukraine, given that, you know, they had an ousted political leader and all kinds of turmoil. And so the administration is being very careful. And it is, again, a way in which they need to gauge what actions they're going to take. The economic sanctions, some are in place. They want to strengthen those. That's seen as being the most fruitful means for the administration currently in terms of involving themselves in this particular situation. You could see that escalate into some non-lethal aid going to Ukraine. But, you know, currently, as we mentioned at the top of the show, the military aid is not something that's really being talked about. And it's really just a situation in which the administration is being extraordinarily careful. If you remember, previously Obama, you know, had talked about red lines being crossed and that kind of thing in the Middle East, and that turned out not to be so useful a terminology. So they're being very careful.
Mm-hmm. American officials, Wayne, have said they want to handle the standoff delicately, also as Donna is indicating, to avoid further complicating this already volatile situation. I wonder if you can help us imagine that the pitfalls, the scenarios that the administration is trying to avoid, the paths it knows it does not want to go down.
Well, I think the biggest fear is that Russia would actually invade Ukraine. And then that would force very tough decisions, make the people in northern Europe, in the Baltics, more insecure. NATO would have to take stronger action, stronger pressures for sanctions. And I think there's a risk of starting a new Cold War if that happens, and I think the administration wants to avoid that.
Mm-hmm. You pointed to tomorrow's meeting in Geneva between several of these parties. Wayne, what do you expect? What are the possible things you imagine coming out of that meeting?
Well, I don't know whether they'll come up with a formal agreement, but I would hope they would agree to keep talking. What I would hope would come out of it is an agreement to keep Ukraine as a single country with more autonomy for the East, with recognizing the Russian language as an official language in the East, hopefully keep things going till an overall election in Ukraine, which is scheduled, I think, for May, where the East then would participate and you could get a more legitimate government in Kiev. And then maybe things could cool after that.
Okay. Wayne Moyer with us, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College, Donna Hoffman, Chair of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa, chewing over the latest in politics, as we love to do on Wednesday Politics Day here on River to River. Perhaps we'll have other comments from our listeners on the Ukraine situation, and that's perfectly fine. 1-866-780-9100. Let's move on to a couple of other things. Certainly developments on this story that has international bearing. Monday of this week, the Washington Post and Guardian U.S. won the Pulitzer Prize for public service for their articles based on National Security Agency documents leaked by the former government contractor Edward Snowden. Was through a series of reports that exposed the NSA's widespread domestic surveillance program that the Post and the Guardian U.S. set off an international debate on the limits of government surveillance. We've been talking about a lot on this program. Papers also came under heavy criticism by the American and British governments. We have to note lawmakers accusing them of compromising national security. The Pulitzer Board saying it gave the award for the, quote, authoritative and insightful reports that help the public understand how the disclosures fit into the larger framework of national security. Donna Hoffman, we have several months since this story broke. It's developed now that the Snowden story has won the Pulitzer Prize. Where does the debate over this NSA surveillance program stand?
Well, I think it's kind of interesting where it stands. And if you notice how the Pulitzer Board talked about that award, they did not mention Edward Snowden in that. They merely pointed to the reporting based on the leaks that he did. And I still think there's a pretty divided public opinion in the United States on Edward Snowden himself. He came out after the award was announced and, you know, basically said he's been vindicated. But he's still living, I believe it is, in Russia. And I think there's divided opinion as to whether he's truly a whistleblower or if he's merely a lawbreaker. And I don't know that that's going to be settled anytime soon. But mm-hmm. I mean, the Pulitzer Prize is the Pulitzer Board is recognizing here that I think it was the Public Service Award that they gave those two papers, that there was, in fact, a legitimate public interest in knowing about the links to which the NSA was going to. And the Obama administration has, you know, addressed those kinds of things. And we can agree or disagree in whether they've addressed those very effectively. But there certainly has been a national discussion about that at multiple levels, at the public level, at the level of policymakers. And, you know, so I think it's still kind of a wait and see as to whether history will look back on this effort as being really significant in terms of the relationship between the government and how it fights terrorism and the public's right to know and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. One thing we do know, Edward Snowden, that name will be known decades from now, Wayne Moyer. We can rest assured that's, but in what light? We don't exactly know at this point as it develops. Your thoughts, Wayne Moyer.
Well, one positive thing that the Snowden releases, so far as I can tell, did not really compromise any agents out in the field or lead to forces opposed to the United States to be able to take action against the United States. And therefore, I think you can justify what the Pulitzer Commission did is the rewarding reporting the news, which is exactly what the media is supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wayne Moyer is with us of Grinnell College. Donna Hoffman with us from the University of Northern Iowa, two of our able political analysts we'd like to showcase on our Wednesday afternoons to help us analyze the political news of the week. Still to come when we return after a short break, we'll talk about a new report released this week by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We'll talk about that and the politics surrounding climate change. Also, a new Gallup poll on the Affordable Care Act showing that nearly 10 million people have been helped to get new health insurance, and more than 4% of all Americans have gotten health insurance for the first time. A new Gallup poll. We'll ask about that when we come back. And finally, during the hour, the political implications of comedy, the decision to hire Stephen Colbert to replace late night's David Letterman. That will happen next year. Some critics on that. We'll talk about it when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, I'll talk with Iowans who were honored this year as Heroes of the Heartland by the American Red Cross of Greater Iowa for their acts of heroism and community service. I'll talk with fourth grader Josh Little from Soldier, Iowa, who saved a classmate from choking during the lunchtime at his elementary school. Also, Baxter police officer Joe Bartello will tell us the story of the rescue of a truck driver. He swam. Joe Bartello, Officer Bartello, swam through the vehicle's broken windshield after it crashed and was submerged in flood water on the interstate. Tomorrow, the heroes of the heartland in the spotlight here on River to River. Today it's Politics Wednesday. Wayne Moyer is with us of Grinnell College. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa spent much of the first half hour talking about the situation in Ukraine, also the story of Edward Snowden winning the Pulitzer Prize. In this half hour, we want to talk about some new polling on the health care, the Affordable Care Act. Also, toward the end of the hour, the decision to hire Stephen Colbert to replace late night's David Letterman on CBS, drawing some praise, also some criticism. We'll talk about that a little bit later, and we'll want to know from you, do you watch Colbert? Why? What do you tune in to Stephen Colbert for? 1-866-780-9100. You can write us an email with a few words or your thoughts on it to rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook to tell us why you watch Colbert. What do you think of this latest move? Let's talk with Donna and Wayne about the United States and climate change. The United States needs to enact a major climate change law, such as a tax on carbon pollution by the end of this decade to stave off the most catastrophic impacts of global warming. That's according to the authors of a new report released this week by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This week's report makes it clear that, according to its authors, the window is rapidly narrowing to forge new policies that will protect the globe from a future of serious food and water shortages, a drastic sea level rise, increased poverty and disease and other risks. But aggressive efforts to tackle change have been repeatedly stymied with the political reality found in Washington. Donna Hoffman, will this or any other report change minds in Washington given the climate there?
I don't really think so. Let's remember that back in the State of the Union address, Obama made the blanket statement, climate change is a fact. And the fact that he said that made news. And so there's still a significant number of people. I mean, I think it's a minority of people, but some powerful people who want to deny climate change. And sometimes it's for political reasons. Sometimes it's, you know, they deny the science. But whatever the reason is, it's very difficult politically for Congress to act at the moment in terms of doing a big piece of legislation that might be able to address carbon emissions. And, you know, we have coal is affected by this. Oil and gas states would potentially be affected by this. And in Congress, you have members that represent those interests because those interests are largely centered in certain states. And it makes it very difficult for Congress to move on this particular issue right now. I mean, polls show that Americans care, even a majority of Americans care about this issue, but it's not really a top priority. So something will have to happen to make it something in which Americans feel more intensity about for anything to move, I think, in Congress. Because, you know, what we're left with, what Obama is left with at this point after his bold statement in the, you know, State of the Union was, and if Congress will act, maybe we can do something. But in the meantime, I'll use the tools that I have executively to try to address this. And he has gone a long ways and somewhat controversial in terms of trying to address what he can with executive measures.
Wayne Moyer, your thoughts on the politics of climate change?
Yeah. The key, I think, question is what will it take to raise the priority of climate change legislation with the general public. Younger people, for instance, seem to be more concerned about climate change than older people are, but younger people don't vote as much as older people do. Will there be something that happens that sort of galvanizes the public in terms of supporting action on climate change? I think it's an open question as to what it would take.
The new poll by the Gallup organization is showing that the Affordable Care Act has helped nearly 10 million people get new health insurance. More than 4% of all Americans have gotten health insurance for the first time, according to the new Gallup poll, the largest poll yet to assess the effects of the 2010 Affordable Care Act, otherwise called Obamacare. It's some findings that add to what's been reported in earlier surveys. Also, that government tally of how many people have signed up through these new online exchanges. Now we have the percentage of the U.S. population that has no health insurance dropping from the all-time high of 18%, which was measured during the last quarter of 2013. That was at 18% to March, just last month, 15%, so 3 percentage points dropping. Donna Hoffman, what is the impact of this short string of good news for the Affordable Care Act having on the debate?
Well, I think it's, you know, interesting. I mean, people who don't like the Affordable Care Act are, of course, denying these figures, saying that the Obama administration are cooking the books. But, you know, as we have seen with rollouts of large programs before, we can look at the rollout of Social Security, of Medicare Part D. The implementations of those have not always gone smoothly, as we saw with the Affordable Care Act. The implementation of that initially with the website in particular did not go well. But eventually, the public usually comes around to these new kinds of programs. And, you know, it's still not clear to me what this is going to mean for the public opinion of this particular act. I mean, I think it's obviously very positive news for the act. We have the intervening election coming up, and Republicans and Democrats both have to make a decision how they're going to stand on this and what their constituency in particular views the act, whether it's just fine the way it is, whether it needs some tweaks, whether it needs to be repealed. And so, I mean, I think it's still early days in terms of how this act will be judged long term. But it certainly is some positive news for the administration, where they haven't had as much positive news as they certainly have wanted in terms of public perceptions of Obamacare.
Could I just add one little thing to what Donna's saying? There's other good news, too. Congressional Budget Office came out this week with a report that Obamacare is going to cost far less than had originally been anticipated, and that the next set of premiums, I think, for 2015 are likely to be lower than predicted. How that will translate to votes is uncertain, but there's more than just the Gallup poll is in terms of good news.
And I would add, too, that I think the long-term projections for the Affordable Care Act are actually quite positive. It's really the short-term, and in particular the election coming up, in terms of how that's going to be viewed both by the public as well as members of Congress running for re-election or their challengers in both parties.
So go a little further with that, Donna Hoffman. If you're a political analyst, you're working in a political campaign, what questions are you weighing in your mind in regard to Obamacare in a Democratic sense or in the Republican Party?
Well, for either party, you have to ask yourself, how do my constituents view it? What is the news locally, either in the state if you're a senator or piece of a state if you're a member of the House? Is it seen as being positive? What is my challenger like? What is the likely tact my challenger is going to take on it? And so you do have a range of Democrats in particular. Some have kind of indicated, although they're still holding back a little bit on this because it's still early days a bit, but have indicated they're going to be more full-throated in the support. Others are supporting it, especially those who have voted, who are on record for having voted for it. But might say, yes, I voted for it. I defend that. But I do see that it needs, you know, this change, this tweak, this small thing. You have Republicans, again, who are going to be in an interesting position if they're gauging in their constituency that it actually might have helped a lot of people and that there might be positive stories in their media markets about that. That they may not be going for a full-throated repeal, which is what they have largely been doing up to this point, that they might also get on the wagon of it's not going to go anywhere, we have to accept it, but we might need to tweak it. So political operatives, if you will, are still gauging how they're going to position themselves on that issue for the upcoming election.
Also, the other news we had about in regards to the ACA yesterday, the news at the Census Bureau, changing the way it asks questions about health insurance So thoroughly that it will be difficult to measure the effects of President Obama's health care in the next report, which is due this fall. This is aggravating critics of Obamacare. So going forward, Wayne Moyer, toward November, what if there is little bad news, past anecdotal news that can be, I suppose, fished out at any point for Obamacare?
Well, I think the big unanswered question is how many people have already made up their minds and are not looking for new information. My sense is this has become so politicized that there's a large number of people who are opposed to Obamacare that no good news of any sort would probably change their minds.
Mm-hmm. The resignation of Kathleen Sebelius, her departure, did that surprise you, Donna Hoffman?
It did a little bit, because I thought if she had stayed up to this point, she might stay longer. But certainly it was significant that she stayed as long as she did. I mean, they let the end enrollment date go. And then it was at that point there was kind of a natural handoff in which she could say, okay, we've accomplished this, we've hit this milestone, and now I'm going to step back and do something else. So it did kind of surprise me, but in hindsight, looking at it, it was probably the best time for her to step down if she was going to. Certainly if she was to step down as the turmoil was happening, that would have not been as positive for the Obama administration. So they kind of used that to their advantage by having an end date to the enrollment period, and that's the point at which they could say, now we're going to transition.
Let's shift as we end the hour here. Donna Hoffman with us, if you've just joined us, of the Political Science Department at the University of Northern Iowa. And Wayne Moyer of the Political Science Department at Grinnell College. It's Politics Wednesday, when we invite you to join us as we discuss comedy in politics. Do you watch Colbert? Why? What does he add to your political menu, political junkies out there? We want to know. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, our email. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Why do you watch Colbert? The decision to hire Stephen Colbert to replace late night's David Letterman drew some praise from many TV critics, but conservative talk show host Rush Limbaugh had a different take.
CBS has just declared war on the heartland of America. There is no longer is comedy going to be a covert assault on traditional American values, conservatives. Now it's just wide out in the open. What this hire means is a redefinition of what is funny and a redefinition of what is comedy. And they're blowing up the 11:30 format under the guise that the world's changing. And people don't want the kind of comedy that Carson gave us, or even Letterman. They don't want that anymore. It's media planting a flag here. I think maybe it was the media's last stand, but it's a declaration. There's no unity in this hire. They've hired a partisan so-called comedian to run a comedy show.
Rush Limbaugh recently talking about the decision by CBS to take Stephen Colbert on to replace David Letterman for a late night. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. I'd like to, that was Rush Limbaugh's reaction to this. Now, this is slightly off center of many of the politics that we talk about, Donna and Wayne, but I'd like to get your thoughts on Stephen Colbert's work and his move to CBS, and perhaps Rush Limbaugh's take on it. Donna Hoffman, what do you have to say?
Well, you know, I find a lot of the students that I have in classes get a lot of their political information from both Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart, which is troubling at one level, but they are in fact getting some content, even though it's in the guise of satire. You know, Stephen Colbert played a character on The Colbert Report, and he's not going to be able to play that same character in the Letterman, I mean, in the late night
mm-hmm.
slot. So, I mean, I think I would reserve judgment to see how he does there. And, you know, I guess I don't put a whole lot of stock in terms of Limbaugh saying this is, you know, essentially the end of or this is an attack on the heartland, because, you know, I will wait and see how Stephen Colbert handles that, because he has been playing a character, and, you know, he'll have to transition to a different kind of role, I think.
Some research on the Colbert Report from the Pew Research Center. This is from 2012, showing that the Colbert Report viewership tends to be more liberal. The survey finding in 2012 that 12% of Colbert Report viewers identified as Republicans, 38% as independents, 45% as Democrats. Your observation, Wayne Moyer.
Well, Colbert himself has said he's going to drop the conservative blowhard role that he's been playing, and apparently people who know him says his actual personality is quite different. My guess is that he probably will follow very much in a David Letterman tradition and probably attract the same kind of audience that David Letterman does. The Letterman show also attracts a more liberal audience and fewer conservatives. So my guess is that new personality, maybe some younger people viewing it, but I don't see major changes.
Stephen Colbert's character on the Colbert Report, a nod, not a complimentary one to Fox News host Bill O'Reilly, his comment on this, that Stephen Colbert will have a hard time attracting conservatives when he takes over The Late Show. I wonder what does – Don, let me ask you this question. Does comedy by Colbert, by Letterman, by any other, let's say, late-night person, shape or simply reflect public opinion?
Well, I think it can do both. And certainly when you have young audiences, young viewers watching things like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, you know, a lot of times they're still forming their political views, their political opinions many times. And so you can have a two-way effect there, I think. And, you know, the people who are in the business of these shows in comedy, in particular political satire, you know, figure out what works. And so you can give younger viewers, you know, kind of a plausible deniability in terms of where they really stand, and they can, you know, kind of scope out what the different things that are being talked about politically mean and where different camps stand on it at a pretty young formative age sometimes.
Mm-hmm. You talked about your students watching Colbert or Jon Stewart. Now, political humor isn't very funny if you don't keep on up on politics, is it, Donna Hoffman?
Yeah, I mean, again, as I mentioned, you know, in talking about my students, it's kind of a good thing and a bad thing, because at least they are getting some political content, but they aren't necessarily also then reading the New York Times or other mainstream kind of media outlets either. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. I mean, I'd rather they be watching at least something and getting some political content, even if it's through humor, than none at all.
Okay. As we end our hour, we have 4 or 5 minutes left. I'd like to reach out to each of you and talk. Tell me about something else that you're following on the political landscape that you'd like to mention we haven't talked about today. Wayne Moyer, what are you looking at?
Well, one thing, there was, I think yesterday, the Security Council of the United Nations pictures brought before the Security Council of torture victims in Syria, presumably done by the government, apparently horribly abused. The question is, how long will this go on before the international community does something to sort of bring this gross set of human rights abuses that are taking place in Syria to an end? So I think that's Ukraine has displaced everything. Ukraine has displaced what's going on in the nuclear negotiations with regard to Iran. That's another issue that we ought to be keeping close track of.
Donna Hoffman, what are you looking at otherwise?
Well, I'm going to be a little closer to home and say I'm watching what the Iowa State Legislature does as it tries to wrap up its session for the year, and in particular what's happening with the Regents University, since I happen to work at one. But also some interesting things that have been talked about relatively recently in terms of gas tax, sales tax, those kinds of things that we might. I think it's not a very good chance we'll see those things happen. But in particular, they do have to figure out what they're doing with the tuition freeze at the Regents universities and the funding levels. So I'm mm-hmm. watching that very closely.
You mentioned the gas tax. Have we reached a level where we have bipartisan support for a gas tax, maybe perhaps not this session, but in the near future, given the state of our roads and bridges?
I think we have. I mean, if you've paid attention to what started happening earlier in the session in about March, I think it was, you had some people, some Republicans even, advocating for increased taxes on this particular area, and they were joined by some Democrats. So it's a bipartisan effort, but it's also a bipartisan opposition to this as well. And I don't think that you're likely going to see anything happen in this particular session in terms of raising the gas tax. But I think there has been enough discussion that it's something that might linger into the next year. Because, at the federal level, there's a gas tax there, too, obviously. And there's problems there. Obviously, the infrastructure in our state has some challenges, and the money needs to be used to fix roads, to fix bridges, safety issues. And there's a growing realization that's, that something has to give, and it's not looking like it's really going to give much at the federal level. And the state wants some additional funds to try to deal with some of those issues.
Mm-hmm. Let me just add a little bit. The Federal Highway Trust Fund is broke. And it's a big question whether Congress will even be willing to take money out of the general fund and shift it. Clearly, we're not going to get a gas tax increase at the federal level.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll watch those issues and others as we continue with our politics on River to River. Thank you so much. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Donna Hoffman, the Chair of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Thank you for your company and your insights this hour. Donna and Wayne, always a pleasure to have you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure to participate.
Thanks, Ben. Happy to be here.
And coming up tomorrow on this program, I'll talk with some Iowans who were honored this year as Heroes of the Heartland by the American Red Cross of Greater Iowa for acts of heroism, community service. I'll talk with a fourth grader, Josh Little. He's from Soldier, Iowa. Saved a classmate from choking at lunchtime. Also, I'll talk with Baxter Police Officer Joe Bartello. He rescued a truck driver in his truck submerged in water. We'll hear those and other harrowing stories, other stories of community service tomorrow on the program. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.